The holidays are expensive. You're paying for gifts, travel, decorations, food, and before you know it, you've blown way past what you were planning to spend. Don't start the new year off with bad money vibes. Download Rocket Money to stay on top of your finances. The app pulls your income, expenses, and upcoming charges into one place so you can get the clearest picture of your money. It shows how much to set aside for bills and how much is safe to spend for the month so you can spend with confidence. No guesswork needed. Get alerts before bills hit, track budgets, and see every subscription you're paying for. Rocket Money also finds extra ways to save you money by canceling subscriptions you're not using and negotiating lower bills for you. On average, Rocket Money users can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Start the year off right by taking control of your finances. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 264 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander.
This episode is part of our Drums of Autumn read-along.
Most skincare products on the shelf involve some sort of trade-off. Either they're loaded with harmful ingredients, but they work, or they manage to have clean ingredients, but they do absolutely nothing for your skin. True Botanicals believes that you shouldn't have to choose between skincare that's safe and skincare that's effective. You deserve both.
With the help of leading researchers from top universities, True Botanicals bottles the highest quality ingredients in nature, creating luxurious formulas that are as potent as they are pure. Third-party clinical trials verify their product's efficacy. Their Renew collection for aging skin outperformed Crème de la Mer, and their Clear collection for acne outperformed Proactive Plus, proof that non-toxic skincare can not only be as effective as conventional skincare, but it can be better.
And True Botanicals is the first skincare company to have its entire line certified safe for people and the planet by the independent nonprofit Made Safe. Welcome to Results Without Toxins.
Go to truebotanicals.com now to get free samples and receive $20 off orders of $40 or more off your first purchase with the code Outlander.
And now, on to our read-along. This week, we are discussing three chapters in our Drums of Autumn read-along, starting with chapter 48, entitled Away in a Manger.
Away in a... Oops, I did it again. Okay. Shot to my heart. And that was the wrong word.
Ginger, don't know any of the lyrics to the songs you sing. I don't know why you're surprised.
I do so. I know Away in a Manger. And I usually know one to three lines.
I'm pretty sure you finished that lyric line with la 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 la.
No, I just I cut myself off.
You know what? I wish I could cut you off, but it never works. I have tried for years to cut you off.
Okay. Leanne F. writes, Away. No, just kidding. She didn't sing it. She writes, Away in a Manger. The title instantly makes me think of the nativity story. The chapter shares the theme of maternity and how the life force is present in the manger as the animals are giving birth while Bree and Jamie discuss her pregnancy and the repercussions of her condition. The manger even feels much like a womb here, where all is warm and peaceful in Bree's opinion. It also provides a private, safe place for Bree to bring up the conversation she wants to have with her father. Martina P. writes, this is quite a difficult and emotional chapter, although the title suggests a more peaceful environment. So let's see what happens. Jamie has concocted a stable on the ridge, partially located within a cave. So it's kind of like, I think he like dug into the ground. Basically, by the time the stable was done, the animals have the option of going into the cave and coming out. So it's like a two-parter kind of thing. With a double door so the beasts had a place to look out, Bree finds it peaceful. She's visiting Jamie there in the stable as he's with their cow who's in labor. Claire had gone with Lizzie to attend a birth at a farm a bit away. Bree brings him his supper. She's already eaten, but eyes a roll, and he, being Jamie, he shares it with her. Quote, "The far end of the stable was fenced off to provide a pen for the gigantic sow and her new brood of piglets," unquote. So just side note, how long does this last? Because I totally forgot the the white sow was anywhere but under the cabin. The stable holds a cow, Magdalene, and her calf. This one currently in labor, and Ian's mare also pregnant. Bree says it looked like a maternity ward and then explains to Jamie what that is. Sometimes, she says, Claire had taken her with her to the hospital and she gets to see the babies. For the first time, she wonders about the sex of her own child. Bree remembers the glass wall that separated babies from visitors to keep them healthy, and Claire telling Roger about how childbirth was the most dangerous thing a woman could do. So many things that could go wrong. Jimmy says that Claire won't let her come to any harm. Bree observes the sow there with all her piglets and feels somewhat reassured by her nonchalance and trust in nature to do its thing. We learn that it's the sow's fourth litter, and she's not lost one, nor had one runt. Jamie says, if the brindled cow, that's the cow he's with, if she can't give birth on her own, he'll have to slaughter her. He'll try and save the calf and hope that Magdalene will foster it.
That's some Jamie Fraser keeping it real.
Huh. He rarely sugarcoats.
I know, but that was like especially like...
Low-cutting?
Well, not low-cutting. It was just like brutal, like honest, blunt, all of those things. You were just like, okay. Like, and I mean, and Brianna made a really good point. She was like, you know, I wonder if the butcher whispers sweet nothings to its future victims. It's the dichotomy of Jamie Fraser.
Bree has a hard time reconciling what her father might have to do to slaughter the cow and him scratching that same cow's head and calling her a sweet lass. Cindy R. writes, Bree is full of disquieted thoughts in the stable, full of either newly delivered or laboring animals. Concern about giving birth, whether she will survive it, given the very limited medical treatment available at the time. Her fear is palpable. Leanne F. writes, here in this quote-unquote pastoral setting, Bree is thinking about her own pregnancy as a, quote, time bomb waiting, unquote, and how she fears not surviving the birth. She is recognizing how complicated life can be and ponders how her mother and father can be both nurturing people, but at the same time ready to step in and make life and death decisions as necessary. She sees that Jamie is ready to slaughter the young cow if the calf's life is in jeopardy, and her mother must constantly make equally tough decisions for her patients in dire circumstances. Brianna asks him something she's been working up to ask. Did he kill Jack Randall? Clara told her about him, and she then tells him that she knows what happened to him at Wentworth. Well, that's a way to bring it up, Bree. I mean, there's no, like, hinting around. If you're going to bring it up, just tell him what you do know so he doesn't have to pussyfoot around. She invokes BJR's name in this of all settings. Interesting. Definitely makes sense that it's in the dark, where she has partial cover from the light of day, the darkness partially hiding her face from her father, it being kind of, not secret, but kind of like the womb is, you know, kind of this mysterious place that, although it's a literal place, it's also a figurative place because it's so mysterious and we know the development of a child that goes on in there, but we don't know that mystical, spiritual, whatever that is going on in the womb. And so I can definitely see how this is a very fitting it is an odd conversation to have in this place, but it makes sense because it's kind of an untouchable, right? A sacred place, an untouchable place. He asks why she's asking. And she says she needs to know whether or not it will help. She wants to kill the man who raped her. But if she does, and it doesn't help her, thus she wants to know, did he kill BJR? And if so, did it help? Jamie answers that it won't take the baby away and it won't restore her maidenhead. Awkward. Can we just not talk about that word ever between dad and sister? Dad and sister. Dad and daughter.
Shouldn't him saying that have sparked Brianna to be like, those things have nothing in common with each other. And just because I want to kill my rapist doesn't mean I want my maidenhead back. Those are not related.
I don't think he's trying to relate them. I think he's trying to say... Well, he hasn't gotten...
No, I'm not saying he's trying to relate them, but he's stating, he made it sound like killing him won't do this or bring that back. Because he... Yeah, and that's not what she's asking. And he also clearly thinks that she lost her maidenhead to rape.
Okay, Summer, we're going to get through this in about 2.5 more chapters. This is the thing.
I know, but shouldn't... I feel like it should have come up here, though.
Oh, well, that would have been there's a lot of times it could have come up before now, before it does. But I agree with you. The frustration, and that's Jamie's misunderstanding, while frustrating, you can't really blame him. I understand, and we'll get to this in a few chapters, but I understand, going back to the chapter where Bree tells her mom, I understand why Claire doesn't say anything. I understand why Bree doesn't want... She's in her own way, she's trying to protect her father, right? From killing someone and getting in trouble or being killed. I understand why she doesn't name Bonnet.
No, and she doesn't need to name Bonnet, but I think that if she makes it clear that she lost her maidenhead to the man that she loves and not to the dude that raped her, she didn't have to say it was Bonnet.
Correct. The name is not as important as is the fact that the person she lost her maidenhead to was, it number one, that it was willing, and number two, it was her Roger.
I'm just saying, the next chapter is a month later. We lose a whole month of Roger being where he is just because nobody can, like, pick up a hint and set anybody straight.
Jamie says during the duel, fighting BJR in France, he meant to take back his manhood, his honor. She says, quote, you think my honor isn't worth taking back? Or do you figure it's the same thing as my maidenhead? And that, I think she has every right to ask that question. I think the manner in which she asked it at the end was very, that like got me in the gut. I was like, okay, that's not kind. I understand being upset, but the way she does it, and Diana makes it very clear, is she mocks his accent. She says, or do you figure it's the same thing as my maiden heat? That's not cool, right, Brianna? I understand you're upset, and I know this is fiction, so I get it, you guys.
She also cranky and pregnant. She gets
pass. Well, no, she's all those things. I'm giving her all the grace for this. But when you start mocking the way people look, the way they talk, that's not okay. And I know that she's...
like she could mock the way he looked. They're like twins.
I'm not saying she did. I'm saying that's along the same lines. If I make fun of the way someone talks, it is the same as if... It's not exactly the same because you can't... Well, you can get surgery to change the way you look, but... And you can, you know, get coaching or work on an accent. But my point is they are both very personal attributes. Your voice, how you sound, is how people see you. And I'm not saying she sees him in a bad light. No, she's upset. But it was a low blow, basically. Like, I'm on her side, right? I'm behind her. I'm with her. I'm supportive of her. I don't like what Jamie did. But here, I don't like... He's a native English speaker. He's a native Gaelic speaker. I would say his English is also native. Gaelic may have been his first language, but his English is native. He speaks so many languages. My point is, even though Bree is out of her time... And out of her place as well. It's actually much more Jamie's time than hers. For her to mock him, it's just mocking that gets me. So the truth is, Jamie doesn't know whether he killed him, BJR, or not. He did die at Culloden, and Jamie was there. Quote, I woke on the moor after the battle with Randall's corpse on top of me. I ken that much and not much more. And then he shows her her the sky on his thar, the scar on his thigh. Once he saw that Randall was dead, and how many were dead after the battle. Quote, I thought I could leave him to God then. But Brianna pushes him. But you're all right? After what he did to you? Jamie says, not many die of it, lass. And she says, not yet. We'll see in 6 months if I die of it. And that rattled him. Then he says to her, you'll do fine. You're wider through the hip than yon wee heifer. And she goes, like your mother? Everybody says how much I'm like her. I guess she was wide through the hip too, but it didn't save her, did it? So that is maybe of the same tone that she used when she mocked his pronunciation. But here it's definitely out of fear and frustration, all of it. Whereas the first one definitely could have been, but this one, it didn't seem as personal. It was still, you know, not flippant. It was still a dig, but she's like, look, do you understand what I'm trying to say? Do you understand that the result of the thing that you went through, like, and he's right, you don't die of it, but she's like, I literally could. Quote, she understood then that his promise of protection was in good part illusion. He would kill for her, yes, or willingly die himself. She had no doubt. He would, if she let him, avenge her honor, destroy her enemies. But he could not defend her from her own child. He was as powerless to save her from that threat as if she had never found him. Unquote. She's afraid she'll die. He insists she won't. But she's too scared. He says that her mother will be there to care for her. And she says, you know what's the worst? You said it wasn't my fault, but it is. I should have fought. I shouldn't have let him, but I was scared of him. If I'd been brave enough, this wouldn't have happened. But I wasn't. I was scared. And now I'm even more scared. You can't help, and neither can Mama. And I can't do anything either. I keep thinking, if I kill him, that's something I can do. It's the only thing I can do. If I have to die, at least I'll take him with me. And if I don't, then maybe I can forget if he's dead. But Jamie says, mm-mm, you will not forget. Leanne F. writes, Bree needs to speak to her father about her anger and desire for vengeance against the man who raped her. She is wanting to take action and kill this man in order to move forward with her life. The first time I read the book, I was surprised at how brave Bree was in exposing her father's own trauma at the hands of Jack Randall. But Jamie is willing to discuss even this with Bree after he recovers from the knowledge that Bree knows about his own rape experience. His understated request for Bree to be still, so he can get his mind around what she is saying, is so Jamie Fraser. And his ability to uncover her fears and emotional distress through his questions shows that he is a great father, even though he has only known Bree for a short time. Jamie cannot assure Bree that killing her attacker would bring her any peace, since he cannot say for sure that he killed Jack Randall. He has had to live with uncertainty and the not knowing and figure a way to make peace with his past despite the not knowing. I really like the ambiguity here and the fact that Jamie has never been certain what happened the last meeting with Jan Randall, the person, the sister, with Jack Randall. The uncertainty is much more difficult to deal with than knowing one way or another. The event does not have a tidy ending and still remains a mystery that Jamie must confront now and then. Jamie is determined to find her a husband. He says, if you won't tell me the name of who did this, and she is astounded at the suggestion that she'd marry the man who did this. Jamie lets on that she might be playing the truth a bit. She tries to swing at him at this suggestion, but he stops her. Quote, you're no the first lass to make a slip and try to hide out. But, or maybe it was that she wanted him and he left her. Jamie is doing something very calculated here. He grabs her, holds her, and she tries to fight him. He sings a song and tickles her in the ribs. She screams at him. She tries to bite him and he whips her through the air and she lands on her knees. He's holding her solidly, really, really pushing her. He forces her head down till she almost can't breathe. Then she tells him to stop. He continues to hold her and says, I could break your neck. I could kill you, so Then he moves her and forces her to move so that her legs are spread to keep her balance. He says, quote, I could use you as I would. Could you stop me, Brianna? Answer me. And she yells, no. Then she's free. She's in a heap on the floor, on the straw, sobbing. She says, damn you, I want to kill you. He replies, but you can't, can you? He emphasizes, you can't. And then it hits her. She couldn't have forced Bonnet to stop. She couldn't have fought him off, and it hadn't been her fault. This is one of the strangest, at first, and strongest lessons Diana has any of her characters learn in my recollection, in my mind. It's so very harsh, but so very revealing. And it had me weeping, at least the first few reads, right along with Brie.
What did you think was happening when it started?
Oh my God. I thought, Brianna, bring back your words, because he's being a straight up... I thought, he thought, she... I mean, it is actually part of the narrative. Like, it comes... I don't know if it happened before, but it comes up in another chapter or two. He doesn't stay on it or in it, at least in front of her, very long. But... Jamie's thought, he's had thoughts like, was she really raped? Or she legit was with someone, but was she really raped? Did she do something and then change her tale or, you know, call whatever the exact things he started to say at the beginning of that scene. I was like, what is he doing? And then, of course, once they start the scuffle and then you see what he's doing, you realize it. But when they first started to like get physical, the first time through, I was like, what the hell, Jamie?
It was real out of character.
Right? Exactly. Like, how do you defend that? What is even, I mean, after the fact, you can look back and say, oh, okay, I get it. This is something, and that's why I said it's one of the strangest lessons to learn, because it is something that... There are some things. I am not suggesting anyone do that at all, but there are some things in many things in life, or maybe some things in life, I don't know, that you can hear and you can give lip service to and you can know with your head and say, okay, you know, but in your heart's like, no, I really should have done this. Or your emotions are like, no, but I should have done that. Whatever it is, whether it's this kind of God forbid situation or this kind of situation or something that's not violent, you know, it doesn't have to be a violent situation. For you to know in your mind is maybe one thing, or at least have an idea in your mind, but for you to feel it in your body, in your muscles, in your neck, in your lungs, like he was pushing, I mean, physically, obviously, he was pushing every single button to scare her to death or to give her, he obviously didn't want to hurt her, but he wanted to be rough enough to show like, look, I'm going to give it to you. Summer, don't take that anywhere. I'm going to give it to you and I'm going to show you what you think is not true. And I agree with you. You had the perfect description. Completely out of character. So it was like he changed on a dime. He was going from supportive dad to I don't know, but I don't think, you know, you'll never forget. Don't worry. Da 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 da. And then when she's like, oh, but I should have done this and this and this, which you know, I understand. It's very human, and he realized that all the words in the world would not change her mind. And so he chose to do something to turn the tables on her and to show her, literally, it wasn't her fault. So once you realize, oh, okay, I kind of got it. What did you think about it after the fact?
At first, I was kind of like, is that really the only way to show her? Like, there's really no other way.
<I'm wrong.
laughs> And then afterwards, I was like, he's probably not wrong. I mean, it's one thing to like right? tell somebody that you couldn't have stopped them, but another thing to show them that you couldn't have stopped them. So,
and sometimes, well, actually, I think all the time, unfortunately, but it makes sense. And that's why I said your body, your muscles, your throat, your heart, your face, whatever is affected by the thing that you're doing physically, our body remembers, and the things, good things and bad things, trauma, right? So trauma, bad things, and glorious experiences, like things that feel good. You remember and you believe because it's almost like it's written in your body. When you experience something, you know it, you know what happened. So when she probably did, well, not she probably did, she honestly thought that she, because the only description Diana gives us once she stopped fighting was that, or I should say when she was telling Claire that after a certain point, I mean, no, it wasn't fun and it wasn't easy and it wasn't, she didn't want it, but after she stopped struggling, it wasn't so bad after that. That's what Diana wrote, or what Bree said to her mom. So what she's thinking is, to get through this, I will stop struggling. And girlfriend, that's honestly, God forbid I'm ever in that situation. My goal is to get out of there alive, period. I think she was smart. It's not her fault what happened. She did her best to pull a Philippe, and that is think and stay alive. I'm sorry, All Souls fans. She did. She survived. So, however, after the fact, she knows she survived. She got her mom's ring back, blah, blah, blah. Who cares about the ring? But now she's pregnant. Oopsie. And she's like, oh my gosh, I can't believe. No, she's having the repercussions of the attack, right? Not just the baby. That's obviously there too. But she's like, oh my gosh, it's like she's realizing what she did. She had to do what she had to do to survive. But then once she's safely away and the shock is coming through and she's, you know, it's been months now, but she's reliving and rethinking and being re-traumatized every time she's going through this in her mind, she probably is kicking herself metaphorically. Like, I could have at least tried. I could have at least tried. I could have at least tried to fight him off. And Jamie's like, actually, you couldn't. You couldn't have. So, and in Jamie's mind, yes, I'll hint at, I mean, we already read this, so it's not a spoiler, but you know, I like to keep things chronological, at least for the books. I will refer to chapter 50 briefly in that, in this scene where Jamie does that to her, he believes that the person who raped her was the person he gave to the Indians, donated to the Indians, to the Iroquois. And in that, so he has seen the dude, the description of their tussle that we do get from a few chapters ago. He's not quite as tall as Jamie, but he's still a big guy. So it's not just Jamie trying to quell her emotions and change her thinking, like, look, lass, you could not have fought him off. Number one. Number two, it's not just true. His act, his physicality, while maybe a little bit bigger, was very close to Roger's size. So in his mind, it's not just the thing that he's doing. He's also, even though she's not naming the name, and he's not saying that he's, I've already seen him and I know how big he is. You know what I mean? So what he, in his mind, I never thought about this before. In his mind, he's not only doing it to prove a point. It's also in his mind, a legitimate point, not just the fact that he's making it, but the way he's making it, because he is of a size. Roger's close enough that he can, you know, guesstimate or whatever, but it does the force. So yeah. Oy. Brianna says to her father about his own attack. You could have fought back, but you didn't. No, he says, I gave my word for your mother's life. And he didn't regret it. He talks about how young Jenny had taken over the household duties very shortly after their mother had died. So he knows just how strong women are. She makes an observation of her parents' similarity in temperament, that odd ability to mingle compassion with ruthlessness. And of course, we just got a perfect example of Jamie's ability.
Compassionlessness? No. That was me combining compassion and ruthlessness.
Oh, got it. Martina P. writes, I think Jamie's method of making Brianna understand that she was helpless against the strong lion is a direct parallel to Claire helping Jamie out of the darkness in that abbey in France more than 20 years ago. So after the calving was over, Jamie carries Bri back to the cabin, and then he'd gone back out to deal with the trace of the ghost of Jack Randall. He calls the ghost back to him, and he relives the moments of his abuse. He focuses on this energy and then lets it go. And he says the Lord's Prayer. Then he goes through his ritual. Grace came, the memory of Randall's face in Edinburgh with the knowledge of his brother's death. With that, he feels pity for him. And with that, the demon was gone. Jack Randall had been but a man. Quote, and in the recognition of that common, frail humanity, all power of past fear and pain vanished like smoke. He tells the dead man and himself, go in peace. You are forgiven. Talk about a Christ figure, not just there with his hands being nailed at the end of book one, but here, gracious. Here, he is both priest and the person confessing. He's both the person receiving the blessing, receiving reconciliation, as well as the priest giving that
absolution.
Thank you. Brianna would learn with pain and grace, quote, that only by forgiveness could she forget, and that forgiveness was not a single act, but a matter of constant practice. There were things to be done before winter, and if Wakefield didn't come, he'd make sure Bri and the child were safe. And he was glad that she was at least permanently safe from the man who'd hurt her. Forgiveness was hers, not for him to give. He'd be damned for what he'd done. He owns it.
Little did he know.
Dun, dun, dun.
Exactly.
Martina P. I think Jamie's method of making Brianna understand that she was helpless against the strong lion is a direct parallel to Claire helping Jamie out of the darkness in the abbey in France more than 20 years ago. He is helping Brianna and freeing her of her guilt. However, through all this, his own ghosts are coming to the surface once again. He hears Blackjack whispering in his ear and lets the memories come to him. He does not fight his demons and faces them instead. He continues to pray into deliverance and finally forgiveness. It is the power of forgiveness and not vengeance that finally frees him.
Show of hands, who's super glad that he didn't actually use Claire's method?
What's that?
Remember when raising a ghost, like burning the lavender and then like...
Oh God. And then
ended up like doing each other.
His daughter? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Summer.
I'm just saying. Stop. Her method was, you know, great for that circumstance, but it wasn't really Claire's method. It was inspired perhaps by Claire's method.
Oh my goodness. While he can forgive himself, he is still not able to leave vengeance to the Lord and cannot forgive harm done to his daughter. What wonderful and colorful language used by Diana to describe Jamie's thoughts and state of mind in this last part of the chapter. Cindy R. writes, Jamie's shocking use of force to help Brianna understand that there was nothing she could have done to prevent the rape or kill her rapist seems so cruel. I understand why he did it. I understand Bree's stubbornness, but I feel there could have been another way to help her come to the realization without coming to physical blows. I suppose the use of force here isn't much different than the use of force to discipline Claire all those years before her disobedience. 18th century life lessons are sure painfully delivered. Leanne F. writes, leave it to Diana to turn such an emotionally charged scene to the humorous side to ease the tension. Bree says that Jamie could just have told her, quote, he smiles faintly. I did. You couldn't have believed me, though, unless you knew for yourself, unquote. Martina P. The first part of the chapter, I find myself a little annoyed with Brianna as she is confronting Jamie with her question about Blackjack Randall. I can only imagine how difficult it must have been for Jamie to keep calm and how betrayed he must have felt in this moment. I don't understand Brianna's unwillingness to even consider that Roger might be the father of her unborn child. We know that they were together more than once during their wedding, right? Why is she so convinced? Anyways, I find myself very frustrated with her argument that the rapist is the father. Roger took her maidenhead and no other. Why is Jamie still unaware of this fact at this point? This miscommunication does drive me a little crazy. The tension between them is rising, and this time Claire is not present to be the buffer between them. They both end up bearing their souls to each other and still omitting two very important details. Jamie Fraser will be right there by his daughter's side no matter what happens. Such a comfort it must be. I think I could face anything and take on the world with the knowledge of having someone like Jamie Fraser by my side looking out for me. Oh dear, I am getting a little carried away, but this is a very emotional chapter and I am, as ever, in total awe with Jamie Fraser's emotional intelligence. Cindy R. writes, okay, the title of the chapter leads one to think of something peaceful and soothing. Makes me think of being snug and warm with snow softly falling. I'm a sucker for Christmas. Rocking a sleeping baby. One of my kiddos was born late in the fall, so there are a few of these types of nights in my memory. While it may start that way, with Bree coming to the stable to bring Jamie supper as Claire is away at a delivery, it escalates into an intense conversation that is eye-opening, shocking, but cathartic at the same time. I am so frustrated. I think Summer, all of these commenters are with you right now. She continues, I am so frustrated at this point, knowing that a few simple words of clarity could have prevented the complications of Roger's disappearance. Again, I have a sense of things happening in slow motion and I'm powerless to stop them. OMGs, the shite's going to hit the fan soon. I am sure of it. One last question. Did that cow ever have the calf?
I don't know. Are they eating beef in the next scene?
No, but he said toward the end of it, it was like now that the calving was done. So,
well, he didn't say now that the butchering was done. So clearly the calf must have made it.
There you go. Yes. And finally, Leanne F. writes, this chapter, oh my gosh, I gotta agree with Jamie back in Outlander. Quote, you're tearing my guts out, Diana. And where do you even begin? There are so many weighty topics covered in this one chapter. Grace, forgiveness, acceptance, human evil, vengeance, helplessness, the bonds between parent and child, and shared trauma. The scene that ends the chapter is so emotionally charged. The image of him shaking his fist and railing at God shows how human Jamie is, and that he will choose human love over his faith in this instance. I can't wait for this series of events to unfold in season 4. This will be one of those emotional scenes that will have us reaching for tissues, no doubt.
And that was chapter 48, moving on to chapter 49, which puts us a month later. A month has passed, y'all.
November 1769. Claire is going through Dr. Rawling's medical box, looking at the herbs she had on hand. She wants to be able to offer Bree a choice, to choose to not have the child. But she doesn't have enough of any herb that would truly help. Jamie comes in and startles her, and because she's holding her scalpel, she stabs herself. She wraps up her bleeding thumb in her apron and he helps her by holding it up. She says she was about to slice a root. Really, Claire? So this chapter opens with blood. Let's just think about this entire chapter. After Jamie comes in, there are two people. Typically, to have any kind of battle, we can all have battles within ourselves. But typically battles are between at least two sides, right? At least two people, two sides, two entities, whatever. So as soon as Jamie gets in there, she stabs herself. So we have blood flowing from the moment he enters. Christine O. writes, Claire is rummaging through her herbs and tinctures to see if she can prepare a mixture that will induce an abortion. She is contemplating aloud about where she might procure wormwood, Artemisia absinthium, used to make absinthe. Perhaps she doesn't realize that absinthe isn't in the colonies yet. It wasn't concocted until the early 1790s. And we have a link from Christine O. In 1792, a not-so-ordinary Dr. Pierre Ordinaire, oh my God, that's the best name
Pierre
ever.
Pierre Ordinaire. So ordinary yes. Pierre.
Yeah, but you know what Pierre means?
Is it Peter?
Well, that's a name, but even Peter means this, going back to Latin, Petrus. It means stone, ordinary stone. A not-so-ordinary Dr. Pierre Ordinaire came up with a recipe for his patients. It became commercially available in 1797 after the recipe was sold and the first absinthe distillery began producing it in Switzerland. While it's a bit strange for Claire to be musing, And who makes absinthe in the backwoods of North Carolina? It's very strange for Jamie to reply, no one that I know of. Claire is startled by him and jumps. I'm startled too. Does he know what she's talking about? Maybe she told him about it? That's a good catch there. I never ever would have thought about that. What do you think, Sam?
Say that one more time.
It's a good catch by Christine. It's not.
I didn't
only
hear what he caught. The cat is attacking me.
Oh.
Stop. Let go.
Oh my God. He like pierced me. Anyway.
Claire's wondering where she can get wormwood, and Jamie.
Ah, that she didn't realize that it wasn't available in the States at this point.
In the colonies? No. It wasn't even like made yet. The recipe wasn't even made yet.
It was all over Moulin Rouge. When was that set?
That's in the 19th century.
Okay, then good catch.
Well, again, it wasn't just that, because Claire may have not known the timing, right? That's an easy thing for Claire, because Claire knows of it in the 20th century. That's not a huge deal for her to not know the history of it and the timing. What's odd is that it doesn't exist yet, and Jamie is having this conversation with her. And Jamie goes, no one that I know of. It's possible that he just has no clue what she's saying, and he's just like, I don't know.
I'm sure it was more germ talk to him.
Yeah, that too. Casper is a sleep brand that makes expertly designed products to help you get your best rest one night at a time.
Casper's designed by humans for humans. Their products are cleverly designed to mimic human curves, providing supportive comfort for all kinds of bodies. You spend one third of your life sleeping, so you should be comfortable. The experts at Casper work tirelessly to make a quality sleep service that cradles your natural geometry in all the right places.
The original Casper mattress combines multiple supportive memory foams for a quality sleep surface with the right amounts of both sink and bounce. Its breathable design helps you sleep cool and regulates your body temperature throughout the night.
And Casper is delivered right to your door in a small, how do they do that, sized box.
You can be sure of your purchase with Casper's 100-night risk-free sleep on it trial.
Y'all, you are not going to need 100 nights. You know, I expected, because everyone talked about, it fits in this tiny box. I was expecting it to be this like gigantic explosion of mattress. It was not, but it was a lovely like... that's kind of how I felt when it opened up. It was like, it was preparing me for my night's sleep going, and it slowly inflated and it was just like, I'm ready. Lay on me. And I have been religiously laying on this mattress and it has definitely upgraded my sleep game, you guys.
Get $50 towards select mattresses by visiting casper.com/outlander. And using the code Outlander at checkout. Terms and conditions apply.
That's $50 towards select mattresses by visiting casper.com/Outlander and using the code Outlander at checkout. Terms and conditions do apply.
Erica B. writes, we enter this chapter and Claire is examining her equipment for surgery. A little bit into it is a hint dropped as to why the words blue cohosh. It has been used as a medicinal herb by American Indians. Many Native American tribes and later European herbologists and midwives would use this herb in conjunction with others and fluids for abortive and contraceptive purposes, unquote. It appears as though Claire is preparing for ending the pregnancy should Bree choose this route. So Jamie's come in. He's seen her doing something, startles her. She pokes herself. Blood is flowing. Claire tells him that she was deciding what was the best way to abort the child if Bree wanted her to. He asks her in horror if she'd done it before. She hasn't, but she says she could if she needed to. Remember, I told you I killed Graham Menzies, and Jamie's like,
yeah, but that's not the only dude she killed.
That was, who else?
She killed the soldier in the first book that was raping her. Do we not remember that when she stabbed him? He was trying to rape her and and she stabbed him because remember she got the stabbing lesson from Murta and Jamie. The soldiers catch him unawares and he has a gun to Jamie's head. It's not her first murder. I'm just saying.
But she's talking about in a medical setting, I think. She's like, look, I told you about Graham Menzies. And Jamie's like, that was not the same. That was mercy, not murder. Jamie says it also may have been duty. He reminds her of the night they lost Rupert in the church in Falkirk. Dougal had helped his death come more quickly. She says that she'd rather do anything else but this, and that she has considered the risks. She's afraid of killing her daughter. All during this time, this cut is still bleeding. She uses this as an example. It shouldn't bleed like that, her cut. It's deep, but it's not bad. But she likely hit a vein. She could do the same to Bree and not be able to stop the bleeding, and they'd lose her. He looks at her in shock and can't fathom why she'd even think of doing such a thing, knowing that. She knows that there was no way to make him understand, but she says she knows other things, what it's like to bear a child, what it is to have your body and mind and soul taken from you and changed without your will. Quote, I know what it is to be ripped out of the place you thought was yours, to have choice taken from you. I know what it is. Do you hear me? And it isn't something anyone should do without being willing. Unquote. And she tells him he knows what it's like to live with the knowledge of violation. Jamie says one thing he knows is that no matter who the father is, it is his grandchild, a child of his blood. And this, like, sets her off. Your blood? She is incredulous that he'd want a grandchild so badly that he'd risk sacrificing his daughter. He differentiates.
He made it all about him, which I don't think is generally characteristically Jamie. So this was another like out of character moment. Now, the Catholic side of it, we don't believe in murdering bairns and he's, you know, pre-abortion really. So that whole argument is, you know, moot in this time period. But, you know, when you grow up staunchly Catholic, it's all about procreating, 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 right? So the idea that you would want to end an already existing pregnancy is probably such a foreign concept to him. I know she said that people did it in L'Hôpital des Anges. They mentioned that too, right? So that they had, what are the angel, what do they call them?
Angel makers.
Yeah. I'm sure there's lots of things. But I think he just never assumed that that would ever be anything that she would do or need to do.
I agree that he makes it about him. I mean, there's little, you can't really doubt that because, I mean, he goes there. But I don't think it's because him or, yes, he's devoutly or brought up Catholic. I don't think him or other people at the time, and I'm not saying they don't exist, I don't think his reaction was because he was Catholic. His reaction is, again, go back to what I said in our last episode, one of the things that I read like twice with a, and I wrote, I read it in like, I direct quoted it and I put it in one of our promotional tweets this week. Diana lays it on the line. He may be compassionate, he may be giving, kind, and definitely a man ahead of his time. Absolutely. Not 200 or 300 years ahead of his time, but definitely ahead of his time. But he in no way understood, let alone agreed with, modern sensibilities. So I think we have to, and I have to do it too, we have to fight this, he is this or he is that. And I'm not saying that you're saying he is something, but more than anything, he is a man of his time. So yes, he's Catholic. Yes, he's Scottish. Yes, he's all these things. But any other man, whether he was, I don't know about the Quakers, probably Quaker, I don't know. But almost any, at least Christian sect in the 18th century, if I'm not mistaken, that would have been a very normal reaction for at least a man. I don't know about a woman, but at least a man. And if there are historians listening to us and I got that wrong, please let me know, because Diana does tell us that most importantly, Jamie is a man of his time or of his era. He differentiates between what she's considering doing and the angel makers at L'Hôpital des Anges because he says those women had no choice, but Bree has support. But there's more. She says if she gives birth there, Brianna, she won't leave, not without tearing herself apart, meaning she won't leave the baby behind. They go back and forth. There are so many layers to this because they can't finish one line of discussion or fight, right? Every time one of them says something, the other might come back and have an answer for that thing. But then one of them throws in the next thing. There are so many points being brought up, and I think they're all worthy of discussion. Some, you know, we may not agree, but obviously when you're this hot-headed, understandably, I think anyone would be, when you're this passionate and this in the middle of the thing, you can't stop and talk rationally. You can't, and it's not a very rational, I want to say it's not rational. It's a very difficult conversation to have on the best of days. So Claire's firm decision is that she wants to give Bree the choice. And then Diana reminds us that she's there. Quote, "The apron had fallen to the floor, stained with blood, reminding me much too vividly of operating theaters and battlefields and of the terrible limits of my own skill," unquote. She reminds us that this is a battlefield for Bree's choice. Jamie wanted a child of his own blood, having been torn away from both of his natural children, but he knew that he couldn't stop Claire, and he felt helpless, and he did not like that. She tries to soothe him, like he turns his back on her. She goes to him, like puts her, you know, puts her hand on him, puts her her cheek or her the side of her face against him, trying to soothe him and soothe herself by the same means, but he moves her hand away. She says, "It's not her, Claire's decision, it is Bree's." But she realizes that Jamie could stop her, for example, if he broke her hand. He looked at her and only said, "Please," and then left.
Guilt trip.
Claire goes out for a walk to be alone. She's reminded of the coming snow. Soon they would be cut off from the lowlands. She considered sending Bree across creek, but decided that wouldn't be any safer, and she was definitely much better off with Claire, who could care for her. She's thinking about Jamie's plea, her own oath, not to do harm and not to perform an abortion. She knew that she could not bring herself to do one. Not until now. But it would have to be surgical. And if it was to be done, it would have to be now. Bree had taken Lizzie to be with Marsali and Fergus to help out around the house, especially with little Germaine there. Ian was away hunting with Rollo, and Jamie was gone for a while, too. Bree would be back by dinner. Claire turns to go back to the cabin and sees Bree's horse. Well, there we go. It's time to ask. Bree says she did think about it. And Claire is honest. If we do, it would have to be surgical and it would hurt. Bree thinks. And she asks Claire if she would have done it, if she could have. Claire says, absolutely not. But Bree remembers Claire saying that for a bit anyway, she'd hated her while she was pregnant with her, because it's what forced her to leave Jamie before Culloden. She says it was a terrible time. People were starving. It was war. And most importantly, she had not been conceived in rape. She loved her father. She asks Bree if the possibility of it being Rogers were enough for her. Bree describes what Claire calls the implantation. So she describes this little, this pain she had. And Claire says, oh, that pain you had a few days after was likely the implantation.
I did not have that experience.
She describes how she lay with Roger. He pulls out every time. 2 days later, she's raped by Bonnet. And now what?
He pulls out every time. And that's his signature move. You know Roger.
You saw the title.
He pulls out.
You saw the title time of the last episode. It's too late to pull out now. Okay. I believe I'm knocking you up. Sorry.
You're worse than dad.
Did I laugh at my own jokes? I don't disagree, actually. So she had this experience. She woke up. She felt the pain that Claire calls implantation, and she says her reaction to it was, oh, it's you, and then went back to sleep. She somehow knew she wasn't alone, but then she didn't remember it right away. She thought it was a dream. She remembered it, but she thought it was a dream. And it was a long time before she her experience saying, or the dream was, the dream occurred long before she knew for a fact that she was pregnant. And this, of course, makes Claire think about Faith. Then Claire realizes her decision has been made. And she says, Brianna, I love you. Do you believe I love you? I've always known that, Mama, from the beginning. Christine O. writes, I admire Diana Gabaldon so much for writing this chapter about choice. While terminating Brianna's pregnancy is the last thing on earth that Claire wants to do, she understands that it's Bree's mind and body, and it's her right to choose. She's a loving mother who gives her daughter the support and the space to make her own decision without judgment. Megan P. writes, it doesn't really surprise me that Claire is contemplating these options for Brianna's baby. It's also of no shock to me that Claire and Jamie see things differently. A modern woman out of her time and an old-fashioned Scotsman who has lost a child of his own lineage and doesn't want to lose another. It's a tough situation for Claire to be in as a doctor, but also as a mother, whereas Jamie is only seeing it from things from a dad's point of view. I never believed for a moment that Brianna wouldn't keep her baby. She is like both of her parents, and based on all the choices they've made through the three previous books, I know they would have made the same decision. I find that Claire is so independent and confident in her own right, but she often worries for naught when it comes to her two loves, Jamie and Brianna. Erica B. writes, very modern thinking Claire and her pro-choice beliefs versus Jamie and his need for family leads to a very intense argument, and we don't even know yet what Brianna wants to do. I get the vibe that he doesn't think that Bree has a choice in the same sense that a woman not voting or owning property, and that women are considered lesser than in this time period, and I wonder if these beliefs are adding fuel to the fire. Oh gosh, the idea of a knitting needle up my hoo-ha has me cringing. No thanks. Bree didn't actually say what she wanted, right? But I think it's quite implied that she is already attached to this tiny being and wants to keep it. Yay, a baby is coming. I'm so excited for this direction of the story. Perhaps in part because I'm a mom. I am glad, though, that Bree had given some thought to her situation and did what was right for her.
And that was chapter 49. Moving on to the last chapter of part 10 and the last chapter of tonight's episode. This chapter is entitled In Which All Is Revealed. And I think that they're using the word all a little loosely because there's still, I don't know, 9 more hours according to my audiobook.
Eileen P. writes, the title In Which All Is Revealed reminds me of a Sherlock Holmes mystery where seemingly innocuous clues lead to the solving of the mystery. Elementary. Lisa T. writes, the title of the chapter is a promise to both the characters and the reader that all the secrets of the last chapters will be revealed. The characters finally begin to communicate with each other. And this was my first comment of the chapter. Oh boy. This is a chapter and a half. I somehow want to label the section made up of chapters. No, I take it back. Not all three. Just this one. Or maybe it's all three. Or like the last 5, including this one. Like, there, ever since Roger came up the hill, I want to call it, this section should be called train wreck.
Or slow motion car accident.
It is still November. Everyone in the wee cabin on the ridge was getting antsy. Roger Wakefield still hadn't appeared. Bree had stopped referring to him even. She had to just wait. They were settling in for winter. And Claire's basically in their pantry, like all that food. Could you imagine stocking up for winter, like, or having to, like, being in a situation, whether it was 200 years ago or now when you're in the country, whatever it is. Stocking up and not having the stock, right? If you're well stocked, that's what I mean. And for winter, and like you had, whether you worked from home or whether you just were, you know, you lived off the land, whatever it was, you didn't have to leave for a day job. And you would literally be, maybe not snowed in, like literally you couldn't leave your cabin, but you know, like you're there, wherever there is, like you're not leaving the ridge basically from like what, November, whenever the first big snows come, until what, March, April, whenever it starts to melt or mostly is melted. How would you feel about that, Summer?
I'll tell you exactly how I feel about that, because I've been contemplating starting a garden up where my boyfriend lives. He has a big piece of property, and I've been contemplating starting a garden. And I think to myself, of all of the things that I would grow in said garden, they all have one season, most of them. So it's like, if you don't have a way to preserve or can or do one of those things or freeze, you get to enjoy your vegetables for like a week. Everyone eat your corn. You only get corn this 1 week when it's ripe, and then you get no more corn. I mean, I'm not going to have that big of a garden, right? So I started contemplating, okay, well, what is it going to take? And I did a lot of research into canning and freezing and how to properly preserve things. So I've given it a lot of thought, probably more thought than I probably should have given it, to be honest. And it's daunting. You know what's cool? They have these co-ops. I don't know. I saw them on YouTube. I don't know if they have one in where my boyfriend lives, but they have co-ops like a lot of, because a lot of times people are like, well, I don't want to buy a cherry pitter that I use once a year, but they have places where you can rent them or borrow them, not rent them, like check them out, like a library. Like you can check out like cherry pitters and you can check out, yeah, you can check out things for like the day or the weekend. So, because, you know, not everyone's going to be doing the same canning or preserving in one weekend.
Now, I may change my mind after one such winter. Who knows? But I would love at least to try it once, to be like, again, not snowed in for 6 months, 5 months, 4 months. No, but to be just to experience a winter like they did in the old days. I know that the trade-off is that people, you worked all year round, right? If you were living on the land, you worked all year round. But in the spring and summer and autumn, you had like you had your planting, you had your care, right? You know, you have your animals that you're...
Your winter is your put up or shut up. So hopefully you've done all of the planning that was necessary. Time when you realize whether or not you did enough. And then as soon as it thaws, you start planning again.
Exactly. So what I'm saying is I would like to experience nothing like the ridge, but I would love, at least in my dreams...
Hey, I'll tell you what. How about the next time the pipes and the plumbing freezes up at Sean's house, you can come up and poop in a bucket and it's just like living on the ridge.
No, I'm not talking about that part of things. I know that's not fun. I'm just saying when you literally don't have to leave or can't leave and it's just the hustle and bustle is literally gone. Obviously, you're probably not going to have internet, probably not going to have much. I want some of the comforts, don't get me wrong, but I'm just thinking like, you know, like having a fireplace and having a... It's a very romanticized version of it. I get it. I totally get it. Okay, so they're settling in for the winter. As Claire is checking on their stash, young Ian pops in asking if Bree's there. He wants a looking glass and a comb, and she gets him both. His hair is pomaded to death with some sort of grease. Yeah, it's bear fat. But he added some incense soap to it, so it's all good. He had on his good coat and was very sharply dressed for Ian and for the ridge. He is to be courting Bree. He's come to be a courtin'. He was barely 17 and he admitted he was doing it. He's so honest. I mean, gracious, he's so honest. He admitted he was doing it because of... It was Jamie's suggestion and it was because of her, of Brianna's baby.
Y'all, first cousins.
And he admits... He admits he's not in love with her. But he's not promised to anyone else, so it's all right.
He's like, I can be married to the tallest lady of the mountains.
Oh, Lord. Eileen P. writes, first, I reacted to the notion of Ian courting with stinking bear grease in his hair. Wouldn't Ian be able to smell the bear grease? I mean, come on, Ian. What were you thinking? Then I reacted to the reveal that it was Jamie's idea, the courting, not the bear grease. He just has to make sure his very pregnant daughter is honorable, aka married before the baby is born. It's his paternal duty.
Boy. They're so remotely located right now that no one's going to be present to see it happening at this point, right? So they could technically hide her away before she starts noticeably showing. You know what I mean? So if, as long as she gets married, the sooner she gets married, the sooner
they could pull it off. Lisa T. writes, the chapter begins in late November with Claire taking stock of her pantry. Fortunately, they have an abundance of food to see them all well fed through the winter. This is one less thing to worry about. Given everything else that's going on, this is a very good thing indeed. In terms of food, clothes, and shelter, the Frasers are in great shape. Emotionally, not so much. Bree appears. She is not amused. She leaves to find Jamie. Claire and Ian reach them in time to hear her say, why would you put poor little Ian up to such a thing? Ian is affronted at this, and Jamie says that he thought of every bachelor within 50 miles before settling on Ian. He even says, I overlooked a very reasonable candidate because he was shorter. Quote, I thought you wouldn't have cared to stand up side by side with him. And what makes him think she wants to be married? Well, that shut him up. What did want have to do with anything? He asks. So Jamie is shoveling literally and says her time to make up her mind is past. She says, I am not going to marry anyone. And then Jamie goes one step too far, unquote. Unquote. Quote, is that how Frank Randall raised you last, to have no regard for what's right or wrong? Unquote.
That's not even the too far. That's just the beginning of the too far. I think that he double downs on the too far when he accuses her of not being raped and then saying, oh, you just decided at the last minute that you weren't that into it, and so now you're going to call it rape.
Yeah, but he already hinted at that, even though he said it before he taught her a lesson. He already hinted at that. That's not new to the reader. It's still offensive, but you don't attack the one person besides Claire, but Claire can defend herself, that he really should not be attacking is Frank Randall. He's dead and he is sacred to her. That's, again, that's just as low on him as her mocking his accent was to me. That was, and I know they're not equal. I'm just saying that they're both low. She loses it. She says, Frank would never have tried to pull something like this. And he cared about me. Then it comes down to it. Jamie's job, her father's job, is to protect and defend her. In this time, in the 18th century, those are the roles. Claire and Ian leave them at it. They say, they'll get hungry sooner or later. They'll come back up. Joby writes, Napoleon described the British as a nation of shopkeepers. Claire, in this time of trial, is checking the pantry. So much is controlled in her house at the moment. Uncontrolled in her house at the moment. It must be a relief for her to do an absorbing task for a while. Into this quiet comes some comic relief. In a well-dressed, bear-greased Ian, decked out to go courting. The relief is short-lived, as he means to propose to Bree. Not because he loves her or it's his idea to be honorable for the sake of the child, but because it's Jamie's idea. Ian's absolute dedication to Jamie is usually admirable, but here it borders on blind obedience. Ian holds a similar moral code to Jamie, so it probably wasn't a hard sell, but it's significant that Ian is quite happy to say that it's all his uncle's idea. This goes down as well as we would expect. Claire is shocked, Bree is irate. Jamie has always sought to do the right thing for those he sees as his responsibility. But Bree does not accept this. She has made her position clear, and it is no one else's role to change that without her permission. There is truly a culture clash here. As tempers flare, Jamie plays the Frank card. It's a good one to use, theoretically. But Bree trumps him. I have serious issues with Frank, but I do believe he wouldn't have pulled something like finding her a husband. This argument between Jamie and Bree is reminiscent of the fights of Jamie and Claire after Fort William in Outlander, and then in Voyager at Lallybroch, where a release of tension and emotion at the loss of innocence in their relationship as two people have to figure out how they are to be in light of new circumstances. So Jamie ends up stomping off and going to Fergus's cabin. Bree goes off to collect eggs. That evening, they were slightly calmer, but only audibly. The insides were still reeling. But they were ignoring each other. And she's spinning on her spinning wheel and making noises. He glares at her. He leaves and Claire follows him. He finally asks, what am I to do? He's just like, look, I want this to end. We can't live like this. And she says, apologize. He does something that shocks me. Doesn't shock me that he would apologize. It shocks me that there's no but. He literally turns on a dime and goes in and apologizes. Did that surprise you?
Well, he did. He didn't do it right away because she was...
He didn't say anything.
No, but hang on. Let me find it. He said something.
She says, apologize. He says, apologize, but I haven't done anything wrong. And she says, well, what difference does that make? So he doesn't just turn around and apologize.
No, he doesn't just turn around and turn around and go inside and apologize. And he had a question like, wait, what? Why should I do this? But he's not. I mean, you can characterize it as an argument. I don't think he's arguing. I think he's asking, wait, what? Like, why? He's asking, why would I do this? I didn't do anything wrong. He's not saying, F that. I'm not going to argue. I'm not going to apologize. She did this. So he definitely has a reaction, but he's not arguing.
I mean, he is, though, with less words. He is arguing. He says, she says, apologize. And he's like, what? Why should I apologize? I didn't do anything wrong. It's exactly what he's saying.
He does say, why should I? But I don't think his why should I, and you can disagree. If you disagree, you disagree. But his why should I is not, why the hell should I do that? I didn't do anything wrong. She needs to do this first. Blah, 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 blah. It could have gotten there. But he honestly probably was like, what can I do? Tell me what to do. How do I do this? And then she's like, look, apologize. Just, it's that simple. And his reaction was, wait, what? What? Why? Like, I didn't do anything wrong. And he still could have been belligerent about it. Who knows? But further than that, he's not outside, because this is not a Claire's thing. This is him and his daughters. So he's not, I think he's smart enough not to argue with Claire because, again, it's not her thing. But I'll put it this way. It surprised me how quickly he just went and did it. That's what I'll say. And he apologizes, and that breaks the ice, and she ends up apologizing too, or saying words to that effect. I don't think she never said, I'm sorry, and she doesn't say, I apologize, but she does say, she admits that she had done something too. Joe B. writes, once starved out, there is an armistice. Both acknowledge the miscalculations of the other, but we have no treaty yet. I think Bree's dedication to Roger appeals to Jamie's romantic side. It mirrors his steadfastness to Claire in the time they were apart.
Except for when he married Leary.
Yeah, but he didn't love her.
Okay, well, Brianna didn't love Ian, and she still didn't marry him.
I have no idea what you're talking about. It's not related at all. When Claire left, Jamie didn't ever expect to see her again. So, but he was steadfast to her memory.
For all we know, we don't know where Roger is.
I'm not talking about Roger. I'm talking about, you mentioned, Joe B. mentions Jamie and Claire. Oh, she's saying, Bree's dedication to Roger appeals to Jamie's romantic side. It mirrors his steadfastness to Claire in the time they were apart. In their time apart.
And I said, yes. And then I said, until he married Leary.
That, it doesn't make sense to me what you're saying. I mean, I know the English language. I know what the words you're saying.
He was steadfast to her memory and didn't marry anyone else until he did. I'm just saying, he was not that steadfast.
But it's not just the marriage. He also slept with someone 7 years after she left. So it's not just marriage. Are you talking about doing it? Or are you talking about marrying someone?
Both.
Well, and then you get actually three people. Excuse me.
And then Geneva.
Mary McNabb 7 years later. And then what, five more? Whenever he's at Hellwater, Geneva, Summer's favorite person. And then.
Just saying that is not the actions of someone steadfast.
Well, neither are Mary McNabb or Geneva. Well, Geneva was hard because he was. That's a whole. I don't want to get in that discussion again. But Geneva was. He was definitely blackmailed. He definitely did a bad. He definitely pushed it when he. Maybe shouldn't have pushed it at a certain point. But again, that's us as 21st century women, 21st century people. But the way they got into the situation was definitely blackmail. We can all agree on that. He did not have to. He did not have to do anything with Mary McNabb, and he did not have to do anything with Leary. See, that's the thing is, I think it's interesting. I don't think, and I know this is not the point of the chapter. I don't think anyone. Even him going with Leary, I don't think, and I know you weren't trying to make a serious, you're not trying to have a serious discussion. You're just saying, well, yeah, that makes sense. Look at when he, up until the point where he married Leary. But I don't know, maybe my confusion or maybe my disagreement, not disagreement, maybe my beef, whatever the word is with some of what Joby wrote and not so much what you said. I know, because you were mostly making a joke. I don't know. I think you can be steadfast to someone in your heart without, you know, to someone's memory. You're dedicated to their memory. It doesn't mean you don't have experiences. You know what I mean? So I don't, I understand what she's saying. I don't know if it's a good comparison or an equal comparison or a fair comparison, because Jamie knew, I mean, things didn't happen that way, but Jamie knew he wasn't going to see Claire again. Bree has a very good chance of when he left her, he was going to come back. She planned on seeing him again. That was their plan. So the two splitting up are in no way similar.
I mean, they were both separated by a stone.
Summer. Of very different sizes. Okay.
Uh-huh.
But this is her point. I should have read this and we could have saved us all this. Jamie, you'll see what I'm saying. Jamie knows what it's like to be married to someone else when your true love comes back. That is what she's trying to get to. So that, I get it, Joby. This begs the question, if Bree did marry someone else while she's handfast with Roger. I have gathered in my reading that the legal marriage takes precedence. So it's not as if she could get out of it like Jamie did with Larry, right? So what she's saying here is that so Jamie was legally married, not handfast, to Claire 20 years or however many years earlier. And so it's not even a matter of getting out of Leary's marriage, because as soon as she shows up, Leary's marriage is legit not real.
Right.
There's nothing to get out of. I mean, you have to like handle things civilly, like, you know, giving people money and, you know, paying her, making restitution, because that was, I mean, it's definitely not Leary's fault. I mean, I don't think it was Jamie's fault, but it sure as heck wasn't Leary's fault.
It was Jenny's fault.
It was Jenny's fault. No, I don't mean the marriage. I mean, no one knew that Claire was not supposed to come back. She was supposed to be as good as dead. So that I don't blame on Jamie. However, out of the two of them, it sure as heck is not Leary's fault. You cannot blame her for that. You can't blame Jamie, but out of the two, Leary is the one who was hurt in that, or who has to be made right. I think it's a bit rich what, you know, she gets out of Jamie, but that's a different story for another time, for another book. Yeah. So I see her point though. Even though handfast has nothing to do with it, she's saying that a legal marriage would likely take precedence. And that is illustrated when Claire comes back. Yep. There is no marriage, because if you're already married, you can't get married again. So you went through a ceremony that had no meaning, basically.
And you've been living in sin ever since.
Well, that too. However, I think what she's saying is, so if she, let's say Bree did marry Ian here, or soon, whatever, and then Roger does come back, then she's SOL, because I think that's what she's saying. So even though she was handfast before she, if she were to wed Ian at this time, the handfasting would have come before the legal marriage to Ian.
Yeah, but all she had to do was go through the stones and then, you know, 200 years, he's dead.
Oh, I mean, like just go back with Roger?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that's true. It's a very easy out. I mean, it's not easy. Don't get me wrong. Not easy, but it's easy. Jamie tries to get her to understand that he's done all he can to spread the word about Roger. If Roger were around, surely they would have heard something by now. Then he has a brilliant idea. And I agree it's a brilliant, well, these are my words, not his, but I think it's a brilliant idea. My question is,
why are they just now coming up with it?
Yes. You've known that your daughter like has a hand for drawing. This is nothing new. I mean, it's new to you only because she's new to you. But seriously, as soon as he was missing and you said you're going to put the word out, you need to get a damn sketch. I can't even with this right now. Okay. So he has the brilliant idea of her making a sketch of him. Let's draw the image and we'll take it around. We'll share it and see if someone recognizes him by his looks. Oh boy. This is the train wreck part I was mentioning earlier. I mean, the whole thing is like, it's hard to watch. This is everybody's come to Jesus moment, and it is, it's so painful to see. It's so painful to watch. Oh, she starts to describe him. She hasn't even drawn anything yet. She's just describing him. Tall, black hair, green eyes. And the first hint that something's wrong, I mean, to the people who did stuff, Diana writes that Ian starts. And then Bree starts to actually draw Roger. Ian, kind of trying to play things cool, leaves Rollo and goes to look at the paper. As she finishes, quote, Ian made a small, strangled noise in his throat, unquote. He was looking at Jamie, and Jamie was wearing a glazed expression, like a pig on a spit, very apropos. Then Claire is like, what the F? She's freaking out because of Jamie. She's like, is he having a heart attack? What's happening here? And she's like, Jamie is having chest pains? And Ian says, I do. Now, I don't know what he's saying it in reference to, because I apparently didn't write that down. But he asks if that man, the one she drew, is Roger Wakefield. And she says yes. Jamie, out. Like, they're still, Diana's still not giving it to us here. She's just like drawing it out as long as humanly possible. Jamie asks if he goes by any other name.
She says, Jamie, what is it? Are you having chest pains? Do you feel ill? Do you feel ill? And Ian says, I do.
Oh, do you feel ill? And he's like, I do. That's what I hope they keep this. They have to keep this. This is so comical. It's awful, but it's comical as heck. And yes, her Wakefield also goes by the name Mackenzie. So guess what? Funny story.
It's not that funny.
Nope. They had seen him on their mountain. And then Ian adds, well, he did say as he'd taken your maidenhead after all. Like, oh my gosh. Can we stop with this? Like, don't ever say those words again. Jamie says, it was a mistake. And this whole time she's like, what the mother effing fudge happened? Stop saying you know him and you saw him and oh, it was an accident. What the F? Tell me already. She's like screaming. He says, Lizzie had told them that she, Brianna, was pregnant and that the man who done it to her, gotten her pregnant, was Mackenzie. He retells this whole story. And then when they learned that she had been, so it's not only that someone lay with her, right? Not only that someone took her maidenhead. Then they find out, or he finds out, or sorry, Lizzie is telling them that it was someone that she was afraid of. And then they put two and two together and realized that she was likely raped.
I think Lizzie needs to find some new accommodations.
I think Lizzie needs to, yeah, yes. They say they, meaning Roger, excuse me, Jamie, Ian, and Roger, had a fair fight. Because, you know, his size, he was a good fighter, all that. Claire tells Ian to be quiet and shoves alcohol in his face. And then we still don't know what happened. Brianna is screaming, what have you done with him? Claire asks, like, Jamie, what the F? Did you kill him? Quote, the tension in his face relaxed, if only marginally. Unquote. Phew, so at least they didn't kill him. He responds, no, I gave him to the Iroquois.
As you do. Because, of course, that's the first thing that comes to mind. Know.
Oh, my gracious. Then Ian does not make things better. He says, because it could have been worse. We didn't kill him after all.
I had a gun to his head. I could have done it. But I didn't. Come on. No. Give me some props for not murdering him.
Bree is inconsolable. So here's what happened to Roger. They had meant to kill him. At some point, they'd stopped and Jamie walked away to think. Bree confirms that everything Roger had said she'd asked him was true. Did he lay with her? Did she ask for it? Was it at her bidding? She's like, yes, it was. Ian is shocked. And Bree slaps him across the face. She is pissed. He calls her a whore and she punches him.
I think this is what I was speaking to earlier when I was talking about them making it worse and the whore comments.
Yes. Yes. In the end, it was those words that had saved Roger's life. Not the whore part, but the fact that Roger said those things. Jamie didn't want it to be true. Roger could have been saying these things to save his own life. But if he were telling the truth, he didn't want his death. Jamie didn't want Roger's death on his conscience. Though he did regret not killing him. Now, or sorry, not now with this knowledge, but after the fact when he's like, oh man, I can't kill him because I don't want it on my conscience. After they gave him to the Iroquois, then he regretted it. How could he doubt her virtue? Like, man, I shouldn't have doubted my daughter. I should have believed her. I should have killed him. But now, quote, now my heart is shrunk altogether. Not only that you should be impure, but that you should lie to me. Wait, wait, what? He thinks her cry of rape was a lie, but she couldn't speak. Neither could Claire. Claire's like, okay, Brianna couldn't speak because she is raging and screaming and just stupefied, beyond full of emotion. She cannot get words out. Claire, maybe partly that way. Diana does not describe her as such, although it could be because of emotion. But also because Claire still does not want to break her word to her daughter, even at this point. So she does the next best thing, and that is she brings out the ring and puts it on the table. And she lets the ring speak. Ian lets on. Wait, that's the ring Bonnet took from you, Auntie? Yes. Jamie asks Claire where she got it. Bree says she brought it to her, because Jamie goes like he's looking at Claire horrified, not even horrified. He's looking at Claire like daggers at Claire, like, did she go to him? Like, what the hell? How do you have this? And Brianna's like, you don't even talk to me. You just step off right now. I brought it to her.
Well, because she's like, who else are you going to call a whore tonight? You're going to see it. You already called me a whore. Oh, you can't go after mom like that.
She says, don't you dare look at her that way. She says she got it from him. And then the way she gets these words out is like, it's like punctuated. She's like, when he raped me. Just the worst feelings ever. Then Jamie cracks. Quote, Jamie's face cracked suddenly as though some explosion had burst from him within. I made an incoherent sound of distress and reached out for him, but he whirled away and stood rigid, back turned to us. Unquote. So not only had he directly endangered Roger, he is now blaming himself for his daughter's rape.
Yeah, this is why you should never help dudes who sneak away and hide in your cart that you're trying to carry a body in, because they're definitely up to no good.
This is one of those moments out of time where you remember odd background things. Claire hears the clock and feels the draft from the open door. She has eyes and heart only for Jamie in this moment, but she can't do anything. Quote, I had sold Jamie's honor to keep him safe, and the doing of it had taken Roger and destroyed Bree's happiness. I could go to neither of them now. All I could do was stand there, feeling my heart crumble into small, jagged chunks. Unquote. Bree stands in front of Jamie and says, damn you very much, you bastard. I'm sorry I ever saw you. Oof. Lisa T writes, this reveal is absolutely devastating for Jamie. He had doubts about Bonnet from the moment he met him. He regretted helping Bonnet escape, and he wants to kill Bonnet for robbing him and Claire. Now he feels so helpless because he could not protect Bree from Bonnet. This strikes a huge blow to his honor. Earlier he states that it is his job to defend Bree. He feels that he has failed utterly and completely as a man. All is finally revealed by the end of the chapter, but it leaves Bree, Jamie, and Claire heartbroken, devastated, and very much separated from each other. To quote Claire, the heart of her family is in small, jagged chunks. There is no way to undo the damage that their secrets have created, and as a result, their family is shattered. Joe B. writes, part of why I like Drums of Autumn is seeing how Jamie especially deals with new worlds and experiences where he is unsure of himself, how he merges his old self with the new, Now there's an opportunity to live as close a life to what he would have chosen before Culloden, etc. Generally, it is working well, yet with the arrival of Bree, his world and has shifted again. And in response to his new role as father of a raped daughter, this is the first time and only, I think, where he acts rashly, with consequences so awful that are solely of his own making. Had he and Ian been quicker to listen to Roger when he came, rather than assume the world is as black and white as they would like it to be, there now would not be a widening gyre between him and his daughter, and a serious crack between him and Claire. A serious clash of morality occurs in sight of the revelation of Bree's consent to or initiation of sex. It's ironic that Ian is the one who takes her to task over her apparent wanton behavior, and Bree rightly calls him out on it. Oh, first she slaps him, then she punches him. As has been the case for so long, and even now, sexual mores are different for men and women. In no way rightly. It's apparently all right for Ian to go with a whore at least once, that we know about. Second, Mary, tacitly approved of by Jamie, who could have stopped him if he really wanted to, but it's probably fair to assume there have been others. Jamie has seemingly had no trouble sleeping with Mary McNabb or using women as he must when the strain is too much for him, as he admits in Voyager. But for Bree to take some control over her own sexual experience, it is a step too far for Ian, who has absolutely no place on the moral high ground. I will allow Jamie a tiny spot up there. He was virgin when he married, but considering the lies he had told about his own sex life, Geneva, Leary, he doesn't really have a leg to stand on. Jamie's horror in hearing that Bree invited Roger to her bed infers that he believes he would be better than she, that it would be better that she were raped rather than slept with the man that she loved. A truly shocking position to us in the modern world, and clearly to Bree, and even Claire, who is caught in the middle of keeping the confidence of her daughter at the risk of damaging Jamie's sensibilities, to which I say to Jamie, suck it up, princess. It is the apparent lie that adds to Jamie's anger, and Bree's own Fraser temper fully rouses her in her own defense, and she tells what she probably should have a while ago, that it was Stephen Bonnet, not Roger Wakefield or Mackenzie, that raped her. In the midst of the next round of accusations, it is a guilt-ridden, devastated, and helpless Claire that ends it. From her apron, she pulls out the ring that Bonnet stole from them on the river. George Bernard Shaw wrote, quote, "This is how the world ends, not with a bang, but with a whimper," unquote. And as Bree coldly, calculatingly, and calmly tells Jamie Fraser, "I'm sorry I ever saw you. Their world is ended."
And that was chapter 50 and the end of part 10. Join us next week when we will be beginning part 11. That's a French word.
Pod you two.
Yep, that one. And we will be...
Not at all.
Yeah, I couldn't say that at all.
Summer, you dork.
So we will be doing 4 chapters next week, but they're all relatively short chapters.
So that means we are at 50. We finished 50, right? So look at the book real quick. Is it 71 chapters or 73?
71 chapters.
So we have 21 chapters left. Do you see how quickly we're going now? We're going to get 4 done next week. That means 17 left. So that we're going to make it. We have more than a month left.
There is like half an inch of book left.
Which is a lot.
It's not. Comparatively, we've gone through like almost 3 inches.
So we put, what we're trying to say is,
we're so far past the middle.
We like, are. I'm saying 50 is pretty good. We've kind of powered through the last 2 weeks. Tonight's was like about 2 hours after editing. We'll see. Maybe an hour and 48. Who knows? Probably close to an hour and 50 at least. But yeah, we're getting so much closer. And a lot of drama. I think the highest point of drama was probably this chapter.
God, I hope so.
Oh my goodness. Because we don't know.
So as always, you can join us to continue the conversation by
joining our Facebook group. And the shortcut to that is www.outlanderpod.com/group.
If you love our show and are entertained by it, please consider supporting us on Patreon. You can find out more about that at patreon.com/outlanderpod. And there are also a number of free ways to help support our show. The most important one is helping spread the word. Tell your family and friends and anyone you know who loves Outlander books or TV show about the Outlander podcast. Thank you, as always, so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode. Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20, OUTLANDER20, for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at @outlanderpod.